Hello, and welcome to the Medical Staff, Well Now What? A snapshot of today and tomorrow during the pandemic webinar, Pulse Nelly. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website as well as our COVID-19 blog. If you have questions regarding today's content, please type your question in the Q&A box or reach out to our COVID-19 support email. This contact information can be found on our COVID-19 blog. To access the COVID-19 blog, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bio. If we do not address your question live, we will do our best to follow up with you after the webinar. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box for assistance. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Pulse Nelly shareholder Ann McCullough.
Good morning and good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ann McCullough. I'm a shareholder with Pulse Nelly in the Denver office, and I specialize in healthcare law. Our topic today is Well Now What?, which is a very broad topic during this pandemic. So we're going to focus on the medical staff and the hospital and issues that impact both the medical staff and the hospital and the relationships between the two of them. We're going to talk a little bit about the federal public health emergency declaration and the president's emergency declaration and how those are really important to hospitals and medical staff. We're going to talk about some of the CMS waivers on the federal side and also some state and agency waivers on topics that are important to both hospitals and medical staff. Obviously, in TALA, we're going to talk about temporary expansion locations, also referred to sometimes as hospitals without walls. Talk about some of the waivers for the Stark Law, the very important issues of telemedicine and HIPAA during the pandemic. Then I'll turn things over to my colleague John Sinowicki, and he's going to talk about some of the issues relating to medical staff operations during the pandemic and under some of the public health emergency waivers for temporary disaster privileging, some of the peer review obstacles during this time of social distancing and mask wearing, communications with the medical staff, and virtual meetings. I'm going to start out with a few key data points focusing on what's happening in the United States of America. We've heard some news about the CDC's website, but there's still a lot of data available through the CDC. And as of 2 days ago, the total cases in the United States were topping over 3.7 million. The deaths were approximately 140,000 deaths, and of those deaths, about 549 were involved healthcare personnel. Interestingly, some of the data that's not on the CDC website was that just a couple weeks ago, it had data about predicted deaths through November 1st, but that data seems to have been taken down. So the data that I'm using here is through the Institute of Health Metrics, the University of Washington, which is recognized as one of the premier data sources for this pandemic. And the deaths predicted up through November 1st are kind of startling numbers, up to about 239,000 if there's easing of mask mandates, and about 182 deaths with universal masks. So based on where we are today, that's up between 42,000 and 100,000 deaths within the United States of America. On the federal side, in response to the World Health Organization's declaration of the pandemic, HHS, Secretary Azar, declared a public health emergency on January 31st. And that was one of the first steps for taking some of the first steps to helping healthcare providers respond to the pandemic. The president then declared a national emergency through a presidential emergency declaration on March 13th. And since we're talking here with hospitals and their medical staff, why are these two elements really important to what you're doing? The key is that a lot of the waivers, a lot of the flexibilities that hospitals and their medical staff have been able to use in order to care for patients during this COVID-19 pandemic require both the public health emergency and the presidential emergency declaration. That's what gives hospitals and medical staff members some of the waivers under the conditions of participation, for example, under EMTALA, under telehealth that we're going to talk about during the first part of this presentation. So we're going to focus, we're not going to address Medicaid and CHIP as much, but we're going to focus mostly on Medicare waivers and HIPAA waivers. And keep in mind that a lot of these waivers that are on the federal side, you still have to look to the state to see whether the state made waivers on the same topics. And a lot of the state waivers will also expire at the time the national federal public health emergency expires. And again, why are we talking about this today with the hospitals and their medical staff? It's because today is Tuesday, and the public health emergency expires on Saturday, which is July 25th. There's been a tremendous amount of pressure, I think, put on HHS to extend the public health emergency. And, you know, both Secretary Azar in some informal comments some informal comments, and then Michael Caputo, the department spokesman for HHS, they've said publicly that they intend to extend the public health emergency. And if they extend it, it's typically extended for 90 days, so that would take us close to the end of October 2020. But they haven't done it yet. If the PHE, in addition to the waivers that we're going to spend most of our time talking about, the PHE itself also is what has allowed hospitals, for example, to get like the 20% add-ons for COVID-19 patients, also some of the federal matching for Medicaid rates, and some of the other telehealth waivers are just based on the PHE. So this is a matter of real importance to hospitals and to medical staff in terms of the structures that they have put in place to try to better care for patients during this COVID pandemic. So what's next? My honest answer is I don't know. My guess is that HHS will extend the public health emergency. But if the public health emergency is not renewed or is terminated, then hospitals and their medical staff are going to have to be nimble. They're going to have to rethink the way they're doing EMTALA, telehealth, temporary expansion locations, HIPAA, and issues that relate to STARK, like leases and related agreements with members of their medical staff. So in my mind, I've kind of broken this down into three stages for hospitals and their medical staff to think about. And again, your hospital system may or may not be in a surge area, and I think the hospitals that are in a surge area are really on this first bullet where they are invoking the public health emergency waivers and flexibilities. They're taking advantage of a lot of the waivers that we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. But anytime you're putting up some of these waivers or relying on these waivers and restructuring some of your operations to comply with the waivers, you need to keep in the back of your mind and in your planning book how you're going to terminate or unwind the reliance on the waivers. Then obviously, if the PHE does expire, you're going to have to unwind some of these arrangements that we're going to talk about during this presentation. And that's possibly on short notice. And again, here we are on Tuesday, and the public health emergency expires on Saturday. Again, you know, my hope and expectation is that HHS will extend this public health emergency, but we don't know until we know. And then even once the public health emergency either expires or is terminated, I don't think COVID's going away. Hospitals and their medical staff are still going to have to consider issues around infection control, how they separate patients with COVID from patients who do not have COVID, and how they address patients who appear in their hospital and treat them with COVID, and also how they screen patients for COVID. So now we're going to kind of go back a little bit then to the when I talked about the three stages with the PHE, unwind after the PHE, and then going forward. Right now, we're still in the public health emergency. And so with the public health emergency, CMS put out a lot of waivers, and we call those colloquially 1135 waivers based on the section of the Social Security Act. And there are a couple different kinds of waivers that were put out. I'm going to focus mostly on what we call the blanket waivers, and those are the nationwide waivers. And if you look at the CMS website, they have the they have a number of fact sheets and information about the waivers. They have specific waivers for hospitals, and then they have waivers for healthcare providers. I suggest that when you're looking at these waivers and how to apply them at your facilities, make sure you have the most recent version because they're continually being updated. The waivers for hospitals were updated July 9th, and then the blanket waivers for all healthcare providers were updated on June 25th. Another thing to keep in mind as you're looking at these waivers, especially if you're with a hospital or a medical staff, is to kind of cross-reference both of these documents because sometimes even on the exact same topic, CMS has used slightly different language in the blanket waivers for hospitals on the same topic as they use in the blanket waivers for healthcare providers on the same topic. So look at them carefully. And again, as I suggested, these blanket waivers really are dependent on the continuation of the public health emergency. You're probably aware that individual providers and suppliers, you know, hospitals, doctors, data trade associations, and states, also applied for a number of Section 1135 waivers. Early on in the pandemic, there were a number of waivers put out, waiver requests put out, and some of them were granted and some of them were simply postponed on the assumption that the blanket waivers would come forward. And so that was kind of a chaotic time, particularly for folks who were in surge areas, for example, like in the Seattle area and other areas that were really getting hit hard right out of the gate with the pandemic. But CMS kind of came through and did grant a lot of the waivers through the blanket waivers, so therefore the individual waivers were not required. I'm going to talk then about several topics under the waivers that that have been approved, the blanket waivers, that are of import to both hospitals and their medical staff. So we're going to start with EMTALA, and I'm assuming with most of this audience, you're familiar with a lot of these topics. That EMTALA applies to any Medicare participating hospital that has an emergency department. So that if an individual comes to the ED, the hospital and the medical staff must provide an adequate medical screening examination to determine whether a patient has an emergency medical condition. If the patient does have an EMC, then the hospital and the medical staff have to stabilize that patient within their capabilities and capacity or make what's called an appropriate transfer for a higher level of care. When the pandemic first happened, I heard some people say, including some practitioners say, well, EMTALA's been waived. And that's not exactly true. EMTALA has not entirely been waived. CMS did have the opportunity to grant a broader waiver, but it did not. The EMTALA waiver allows hospitals to have an off-site location for screening for COVID, and that off-site location can't be inconsistent with whatever the state has done, the state's emergency preparedness plan or emergency plan. But it does allow for an off-site screening site for COVID for persons with respiratory illnesses, so that hospitals can avoid kind of commingling the patients who may or may not have COVID with the other patients and hopefully reduce the spread a little bit. Over time, CMS issued some helpful survey memos to the state surveyors that hospitals can look to and also issued some FAQs on EMTALA. So I recommend both of these documents to the hospitals and their medical staff if you're looking at a surge and trying to decide how best to address patients who are showing up for medical screening examinations for COVID. But there was a little drafting error I think I wanted to point out, is that when CMS put out the hospital blanket waivers, it cross-referenced an outdated survey memo. So again, be careful when you're reading these documents. Dig in, because they don't always give you the full picture of what's available in terms of the waivers. So again, this is a narrow waiver that addresses locations for screening. CMS had the opportunity to, but did not waive enforcement of inappropriate transfers, for example. And I think this has been, again, some areas, an area of confusion. But in the blanket waivers, they limited the EMTALA waiver to the initial screening locations. And they did not waive any of the other EMTALA requirements. You know, having folks you know, having doctors on call, having the process to do the screening examination, making an appropriate transfer. So you need to be kind of mindful that EMTALA, I think, is still going to be in full force and effect other than this issue of the screening locations. And if you look to some of those FAQs and some of the memos that I pointed out in my last slide, you'll see that there is some guidance about how EMTALA applies to these screening examinations when you're trying to separate COVID patients or potential COVID patients from non-COVID patients. Full-on EMTALA is going to apply to any of your on-campus locations and any of your off-campus provider-based dedicated emergency departments. Full-on EMTALA standards apply. There's some loosening or EMTALA standards don't apply in several contexts. For example, if a hospital sets up a parking lot drive-through testing, and we've all kind of seen those, CMS has said that that's more in the nature of triage. And recall that triage is not the same as a medical screening examination. So you're not required to use what's referred to as qualified medical personnel. For example, if your hospital has RNs who are not designated as qualified medical personnel, as long as they're the kinds of practitioners who can, you know, identify whether a patient is in dire straits and might need further examination when they see them at the car, you can have those folks doing the actual swabs. EMTALA doesn't apply to off-campus provider locations that are not emergency departments. For example, if you have an off-campus provider-based physician practice and you decide to start sending COVID patients over there, CMS is saying that that's not going to invoke all of the EMTALA standards. And also off-campus locations that are not provider-based, like if you set up an empty office building and just have COVID screening there, don't treat it as provider-based, that's not going to be governed by EMTALA. Oh, and again, before I go off of that topic, with EMTALA, again, if you have these off-campus locations, have in your back pocket, have a plan so that if the public health emergency is allowed to expire either now or maybe 90 days from now, that you have a plan to address any surge that's happening in your community at that time so that you can still take care of your patients. I'm going to spend a few minutes on temporary expansion locations. Sometimes these are referred to as hospitals without walls. This, again, is a hospital issue that's going to involve the medical staff because this might mean that the medical staff is staffing locations that are not your typical locations for inpatient or outpatient hospital services. What CMS did is they waived some of the conditions of participation to allow some temporary expansion locations. This could be, for example, in MOBs, empty space that was in the hospital, off-campus space, a patient's home, hotels. And again, sometimes these are referred to as hospitals without walls. CMS also waived some of the provider-based rules. And without getting into a lot of detail, this allows if you have an on-campus provider-based location, you can extend that provider-based location to an off-campus location and still get the full outpatient payment. For example, if you have an empty office building, again, patients' homes for some outpatient services. But again, to the extent that CMS has not waived all of the conditions of participation, they fully apply to these temporary hospital expansion locations, and that includes all of the medical staff conditions of participation. One important thing to keep in mind with these temporary expansion locations is we're not talking a lot about state law here, but the temporary expansion locations have to be affirmatively approved by the state, and this is one of the few waivers where CMS actually requires approval by the state, as opposed to the waiver simply not being inconsistent with the state emergency plan, those double negatives. So the locations really do have to be approved by the state for you to take advantage of those expansions. I'm going to turn a little bit to ambulatory surgery centers. ASCs have been hit really hard with the surge areas because of the suspension of elective surgeries, largely driven by state law issues in some of the locations with a heavy COVID surge. So these ASCs have sometimes been sitting empty. And again, this involves some of the relationships between hospitals and their medical staff, because a fair number of ASCs are either owned by members of your medical staff or might be a joint venture with between a hospital and potentially medical staff members. So with the ASCs, if they're sitting idle during a COVID surge in your region, they can be used as an opportunity. This space can be used as an opportunity to, you know, kind of isolate patients again, perhaps stop the spread of COVID, to allow this space to be used for necessary surgeries that are not elective surgeries, but necessary surgeries during a COVID surge, to isolate those patients from patients who might be in your inpatient units, in your ED. So there are a couple of different options for ASCs to be utilized, but you do have to be mindful of all of the conditions of participation that are not waived. So initially, an ASC can enroll in a hospital under the very streamlined enrollment process, and a lot of states have kind of a comparable streamlined enrollment process. So during the public health emergency, you flip the ASC over to becoming a hospital. And again, that ASC does have to be very mindful that you have all of your COPs covered, all of your hospital conditions of participation covered, except for those that are waived, of course. And that includes making sure that you have a medical staff and that your medical staff for this newly constituted hospital is indeed constituted and functioning appropriately. ASCs can also furnish hospital services under arrangements. I'm not going to get into this one right now too much because it's a kind of a complicated analysis of under arrangements. But an under arrangements is, if you may recall, these were very popular about 10 years ago or so before CMS cracked down on them a bit. But under arrangements, the hospital services are furnished by a third party. For example, here in ASC, they're billed by the hospital, but they're billed by the hospital under the hospital's provider number. So you do have to be cautious if you're thinking about this kind of a setup to make use of an otherwise underutilized ASC. Another fairly practical option for an underutilized ASC is to have the hospital simply lease the ASC as temporary hospital space. Again, this takes advantage of the temporary expansion sites. But this hospital location then is part of the hospital and does have to comply with all of the Medicare conditions of participation that otherwise apply to a hospital location. So if a doctor, for example, had privileges at the ASC and doesn't have privileges at the hospital, that doctor can't practice at this ASC while it's being leased by the hospital until such time as that doctor becomes privileged. And again, with all of these ASC options, keep in mind, you know, that you have to have a plan to unwind them. The moment you go into these arrangements, you should have in the back of your mind, how are you going to unwind these upon expiration of the public health emergency? I'm guessing, again, that most of this audience is very familiar with the Stark Law, and as you know, if a physician has a financial relationship with an entity that furnishes designated health services, that would include a hospital, the physician cannot refer and the hospital cannot bill Medicare for those services unless an exception applies, and there are a number of exceptions. One of the common themes for exceptions that allow referrals is that any arrangements between the physicians and the hospital have to be consistent with fair market value. Now, during this pandemic, during the public health emergency, there are some waivers for the Stark Law. The waivers, though, have to be what CMS defined as solely related to the COVID-19 public health emergency. So what does that mean? It does, you know, CMS has said that if an arrangement is going to be solely related, it has to relate to either the diagnosis and treatment of COVID or medically necessary patient care, and that doesn't necessarily have to be related to COVID. Other examples are the availability of healthcare providers, alternate settings. Again, we've talked about these temporary expansion sites, or to address medical practice or business interruption. And that's a hugely broad broad exception. So for purposes of kind of the hospital and the physicians on the medical staff who may refer patients over to the hospital, the waivers do allow the hospitals or the physicians to pay above or below fair market value for certain things. And again, rent, we talked about the ASCs, that could be involved, items or services. You know, for example, if an ASC had some extra PPE and you wanted to buy that from the physicians, that arrangement could be above or below fair market value because it does relate solely to the COVID-19 public health emergency. One of the interesting little things is that hospitals can provide benefits kind of beyond the narrow incidental medical staff benefits. For example, meals, laundry, childcare, while the docs are at the hospital and taking care of patients. Few other exceptions is that if physicians own an ASC, the ASC gets flipped to a hospital in the last couple of slides that we talked about. That physician owner then may refer to the hospital. Under ordinary circumstances, there are very narrow exceptions for physicians referring to a hospital-owned owned hospital. And on that topic, if the physicians already own a hospital, they can expand some of the facilities, beyond kind of this the stop that CMS put on expansion. Be mindful, though, if you're looking at any of the exceptions, be mindful of mini-STARK, state mini-STARKs, and also be mindful of the anti-kickback statute. I can't get the slide to advance. Is that something that Emma could help me with?
Looks like it's on the next one.
Okay, on my screen it is frozen. So, John, could I ask you to advance?
Sure thing.
Okay. Sorry about that. So I'm on critical access hospitals, and on critical access hospitals, as you're probably aware, there are location and restrictions and short-term treatment exceptions. The critical access hospitals have to be within 35 miles of the next closest hospital, 15 miles if it's like a mountainous region like Colorado, and patients have to be there for short-term care, 96 hours, and it's capped out at 25 beds. So during the public health emergency, critical access hospitals have a bit more flexibility to expand their bed limits, to not kick patients out after 96 hours and find a place to transfer where to transfer the patients to after 96 hours. And one of the important waivers for physicians to think about is that CMS did waive the requirement for the physicians to be physically present in the hospital, in the critical access hospital. Instead, the physicians can be available just through direct radio or telephone communication with the hospital. So again, I think that's helpful for the critical access hospitals and their medical staff members. But again, keep in mind that this does have to be unwound should the public health emergency go away. I'm going to switch over to telemedicine and telehealth for a few slides here. And telemedicine has, as you're probably aware, has simply exploded during the last several months of COVID. And again, during the public health emergency and the presidential emergency declaration, CMS has really expanded access to telehealth. Some of the COP elements have been waived, and Medicare has expanded coverage beyond the rural areas. The COPs that are waived, for example, the governing body under the conditions of participation has significant obligations for the types of agreements that go into place for telemedicine, and some of those COPs have been waived. This also expands, you know, the types of providers who can engage in telehealth services. And CMS has put out a list of services that may be furnished via telehealth. Let's go to the next slide, please. On the Medicare reimbursement, I think this is really important for hospitals and physicians to think about, is that some of the reimbursement has really been expanded during this public health emergency. So, for example, telehealth services are paid under the Medicare fee-for-service at the same rate as in-person services. So you're not going to take a pay cut because you switch from inpatient in-person services to telehealth services, which I think really, again, encourages the use of telehealth to keep patients safe and keep patients out of the hospital if they don't really need to be in the hospital. The Medicare put out some relief for cost sharing for patients who receive telehealth. And again, the billing issues, you report the E&M codes, E&M visits based on either time or the medical decision making. And one of the things is that Medicare is also going to pay for some non-telehealth services, services that are not traditionally considered to be telehealth and more in the nature of telecommunications. So I think that's a very helpful change, for example, to allow for remote monitoring of patients. Let's go to the next slide then. So on some of the technology that CMS requires telehealth services to be furnished using audio-visual with real-time interactive communications. In a fairly significant waiver, CMS is now allowing audio-only telephone E&M visits, which I think is another pretty big change that's helpful during this pandemic. Let's go to the next slide then, on the place of service and the originating site. So the place of service is there's some flexibility. So the place of service is really where the physician would have been if the services were provided in person. So that's another very helpful expansion of telehealth. It's got a little information about how you bill with the telehealth modifier 95. So you should be appending that to all of your claims. But there is a caveat here about what you're reporting as telehealth and what you're not reporting as telehealth. So if you're reporting something as telehealth, it's not telehealth. For example, if the physician's at the same location as the patient. So for example, I think a good example of that is like if you have a tent on your campus for the COVID screening that you're treating as part of the hospital, but the ED doc is in the ED and is not going out and physically examining the patient, but instead is using telecommunications technology to examine the patient while that patient's in the COVID screening tent. That is not technically a telehealth service. That instead is treated as an in-person service. Let's go to the next slide where we're going to talk about some of the state telehealth waivers. Again, with all of these federal waivers, we have to be mindful of what's happening on the state level. So you do need to look to what the state is doing about commercial payers, whether the states have approved some of the licensure waivers so that physicians from outside the state who might not have a license in your state are still allowed to furnish care versus telehealth. And again, we've been seeing a number of states also kind of follow CMS's guidance and allowing audio-only telehealth. Go to the next slide then. These stats are just Medicare only. More than 9 million patients during the between March and mid-June. More than 3 million of those had audio only, which again is why it's so important to look not just at the CMS waivers but also at your state waivers. And again, you recall that Medicare was really paying only for rural before the pandemic, but now they're about 22% of the Medicare patients were indeed rural, and about 30% of those were in 30% in urban areas. So what's next? The next slide, please. What's next on telehealth? I think it's going to be really hard for this genie to go back in the bottle. I think that telehealth has shown some of its promise. It's been very helpful for a lot of our clients who are in significant surge areas have been leaning very heavily on their ability to use virtual care instead of in-person services to prevent the spread of COVID. So CMS is saying that they're looking at some permanent changes, some permanent expansions to telehealth, and hopefully some of those will go into place before the PHE, the public health emergency, is allowed to expire. We're keeping an eye on the Medicare fee schedule, which is coming out kind of later this month, and we think that there might be some expansions of telehealth waivers, some permanent expansions in the upcoming Medicare physician fee schedule. So again, kind of stay tuned on that. Next, I'm going to switch gears a little bit to HIPAA. So on HIPAA, you have to be really cautious about all of this because I have heard some people say, well, HIPAA's waived. Well, HIPAA is not really waived. Instead, OCR has really waived some narrow aspects of HIPAA, some very practical waivers, and you can kind of look those over on your own. But again, just keep in mind that the rest of HIPAA still is intact, and you still have to be very mindful of HIPAA. Let's go to HIPAA and telehealth, because I think for the relationship between medical staff and hospitals and how you're really kind of trying to roll out telehealth, there's some really important, relief from OCR, to allow the use of different technologies during this pandemic. So, and this is really about OCR's enforcement discretion, that they're not going to impose penalties for noncompliance. You know, when you're looking at the good faith provision of telehealth, using non-public facing audio and video. So it can't be a public facing, but so there's still some expectation of privacy. But again, this applies to telehealth provided for any reason, which means that you're not limited in using this technology just for COVID patients. You can use it for non-COVID patients who you don't want to bring into your hospital, you don't want to bring into your medical office to avoid the spread of of COVID. This does not apply, though, to business associates. So if you're acting as a business associate, be careful. You do have to still be mindful of encryption and privacy modalities, and still provide notice of your privacy practices and get a BAA, a business associate agreement, when you can. Let's go to my last slide for my part of the presentation. And this is telehealth and Joint Commission. And Joint Commission has been kind of surprisingly quiet during this pandemic. And so I think that when facilities are looking at what's happening with the waivers and why Joint Commission is being quiet, it does create a little bit of confusion. But one thing that Joint Commission did say during this public health emergency is that if you have doctors who are currently credentialed at the hospital, they can furnish the same services using a telehealth link, so that doesn't require additional credentialing or privileging. Although the medical staff should be identifying which services are appropriate for the telehealth link. For example, remember earlier on I talked about having an ED doctor sitting in the ED and having the patient being screened for COVID in a tent that's on the hospital's campus right outside the ED door. Joint Commission is kind of confirming that in that type of scenario, you can definitely use a telehealth link. It's not really a telehealth service, but it's instead, from Medicare's perspective, they're treating that as the same as an in-person service. But you don't have to go through any additional credentialing in order to make that happen. So with that, sorry about the technological glitch, but I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, John Sinowicki, to talk a little bit more about how did we get here. Thank you.
Thanks, Ann. I appreciate that. The information I think you provide is extremely important and helpful. And so, with that as sort of the background, I'm going to talk, as Ann suggested, about some of the peer review challenges and some of the just the technicalities of working through what this looks like for us on this point of it. And so we'll walk through that. I am a shareholder in healthcare litigation out of our Dallas, Texas office. And so we'll kind of walk through, and here's sort of an overview of the things I'm going to talk about, both on the privileging side, but also some of the reporting issues. There's some unique challenges with temporary and emergency privileges and whether or not they become reportable. There are other issues that are coming up with respect to whether you have to report physicians now based on delays in investigations and those sorts of things. So we'll talk about that. some of the just the practicalities of how we're seeing hospitals adjust to the pandemic, ways that it's going well for them to be able to conduct meetings and provide for certain coverages, and what that might look like on a go-forward basis. So first, let's talk about privileging, both temporary and disaster privileging. And we'll talk about temporary privileges first. So temporary privileges are, there's really two circumstances where they're done. The first is to fulfill an important patient care need, where you've got something that's got to be done because you don't have somebody on staff that can do it. Or it can be done when you have an applicant for new privileges, and we'll talk about what that means in a second, that has a complete application that raises no concerns and is awaiting review by the MEC and the governing body. What that means is that you've got to have essentially a clean application for a practitioner, nothing that's going to require additional questions or concerns about what that provider's background is, or to clear up red flags that they may have on their file. It's got to be a clean application. For new privileges, it's not just an initial applicant. It could be an initial applicant for someone applying the first time, but it also includes a current practitioner on your staff who's requesting additional privileges, and an individual who is in the reappointment process is requesting one or more additional privileges as well. And that's taken directly from how the Joint Commission defines that. For the temporary, or the important patient care need, this is the second basis that can provide or permit temporary privileges to be granted. The need's got to be documented in the credentials file at the time the privileges are granted. There's got to be something that justifies or shows why temporary privileges are required here. And this can be done by a statement by the CEO. This can be put in the credentials file. I think it makes it clean if you give a practitioner temporary privileges that there's some sort of a notation in the file of why they were given temporary privileges as well. I think it makes it easier if that's all in one place. You know, in case later down the road you get a subpoena for that particular physician's credentialing file, or if, you know, Joint Commission comes on and does a survey, once they start surveying again and they pull that file to review, it makes it much easier for you to be able to say, well, look, here's the documented patient care need that justify why this particular provider was provided with temporary privileges. So here's some examples Joint Commission gives. Patient requires a specialized skill that no one on staff has. You have a locum need, and, you know, patient care volume exceeds the level that can be handled by a currently privileged practitioner. So it may be that you have, five, doctors of a particular specialty on staff, but that you've got a surgeon patient that justifies or needs you to have more. And so in a situation like this, it may be that you've got pulmonologists who are applying for temporary privileges at your hospital, and due to the COVID flux, you have a need for that you can document and demonstrate. That would give you the ability to add them through temporary privileges, or provide temporary privileges for that practitioner. And as we'll talk about this, one of the things that to keep in mind is there are often more than one option with respect to a practitioner of how you might privilege them or what they might have. Sometimes there's not, but often there is. One important note here is failure to timely process a reappointment application is not justification for giving temporary privileges. If that happens and you've got a practitioner who's not been timely reappointed, either because your committee hasn't been meeting because of the COVID issue, or because they didn't get you a completed application in time, or they submitted it at the last minute and there are follow-up questions that we need for information, or we don't have all of our primary source verifications, there's got to be a separate justification that would fit this doctor within the juncture of saying there is an important patient care need for this particular provider to be given temporary privileges here. And we'll talk, and I do allude a little bit to, you know, if your committees aren't meeting, whether or not, you know, the Joint Commission has talked about extensions in this provision, and I'll get to those, and sometimes that becomes another option here that you may have. So we'll talk about disaster privileging as well, but at the outset, the Joint Commission talks about disaster privileging versus emergency situations. And the key here is that the Joint Commission permits any medical staff member that has privileges to provide any type of patient care necessary as a life-saving measure or to prevent serious harm, regardless of status or clinical privileges. So if there's an emergency, if someone's on in your hospital and has a cardiac event right in front of a practitioner, an orthopedic surgeon, and there's no one else around, that doctor can can work to stabilize that patient right now and begin working on that patient and then transfer it to an appropriate practitioner once that care has been provided. Obviously, there's, you know, we're not going to at that point say, well, no, we need another doctor. I'm not privileged to do this type of work, right? I mean, that's not certainly not going to happen. And one example that they give for the Joint Commission is major storm happens, isolated hospital, right? You see this with hurricanes, not only because of the devastating impact, but also because in certain situations, it's impossible to get to where the hospitals are located depending on how the hurricane hits. So if you've got that sort of a situation, you may have the hospital granting emergency privileges to a general surgeon to do cases he normally wouldn't be credentialed to provide. And we're going to do that and allow that to go through until the emergency situation has gone through. And what's interesting here is that, you know, I think the position for hospitals in this case has been, you know, we've been providing disaster privileges. And for some docs, they've been on disaster privileges for an extended period of time. And that is not really, I mean, it's permissible, but it's funny because the Joint Commission did not create disaster privileging with that situation in mind. I don't think that it was drafted with the knowledge or the thought that this could go on for months and months, and you may have a situation where you can continue to provide that care under disaster privileging. So disaster privileges, in order to provide them, they've got to be defined somewhere in your bylaws or credentials policy. They'll usually define an emergency situation that would be different than disaster privileging that then obviously permits the practitioner to administer treatment to the extent permitted by the license. And when the emergency situation ends, the patient is assigned over to the appropriate practitioner. For disaster privileges, what's important here is that they can only be granted to volunteer licensed independent practitioners when the emergency operations plan has been activated. So if you're giving disaster privileges to a practitioner, you've got to implement the emergency operations plan. And I think for virtually every hospital that I've seen, that has gone into effect now with the COVID at one point or another, whether it's still in places, dependent on the region. And what that requires essentially is that the disaster is an emergency that due to the complexity, scope, duration, right, the overall threat, it threatens your capacity and requires outside assistance to sustain patient care, safety, or security. And again, this was initially intended for emergencies like Katrina, but obviously it's been extended to something like the COVID issue that we're running into now. So let's talk about what's required here. If you have disaster privileges, you've got to meet a threshold here before you can give a practitioner disaster privileges. It's one thing if you've got a doctor who's currently on your staff or that you know is at an affiliate hospital that you're giving disaster privileges to and it's easy to verify who they are. But we've also got a lot of practitioners that are traveling from one state to another. We saw a lot of them go up to New York when New York was getting hit. I think we're seeing more travel to different areas now as well. And that's in a lot of cases permitted by lifting of waivers and allowing doctors to do that, but we've still got to be careful, right? Because there's still been cases of, you know, doctors showing up essentially acting as imposters. And so the Joint Commission lays out sort of our minimum threshold to verify that the doctors who are coming in are both doctors and are who they say they are. So before we grant emergency privileges, we have to obtain a valid government-issued photo ID and then at least one of the following. And this is a longer list, but we'll kind of just touch on these quickly. One could be a photo ID from a healthcare organization that identifies designation, right? So if they've got a card that shows that they're in another hospital and it shows them as, you know, a surgeon or an emergency room doctor, that'll work. They can show you a copy of their current license to practice. They can show you primary source verification of licensure. And then there's several others that they'll permit too, including, you know, confirmation that they're part of the DMAT team, that they are granted authority by a governmental entity to provide patient care. Right, that second bullet point kind of fits in a lot of these states where you have states of emergency that have been declared, your Department of Health or your governor or your adjutant general, whoever it's assigned to under the state's constitution and rules and regs, can allow for an increased scope of response practitioners on a voluntary basis. And so this sort of meets and convenes on that point to say those individuals, if they are practitioners, can then qualify and show you who they are in that manner. And then confirmation by an independent, licensed independent practitioner who's currently privileged at the hospital or by a staff member who's got personal knowledge, right? So this is just sort of our initial screening. Let's make sure we know who they are. Once that's been confirmed, disaster privileges are effective immediately. They're granted. And for the hospital, you've got to have oversight by the medical staff. And in a lot of cases, the way in which this is done is by, and one effective way to do it is to, if you have someone that has disaster privileges, is you assign them to a medical staff member on staff that they can work with or be shadowed by or work with. And that helps to make sure you've got oversight by the medical staff, or you put something else in place where one of your medical staff members has a way to oversee the work being done by the disaster privileged practitioner. And you've got to, at 72 hours, document your reevaluation of the practitioner. And what that means is that you've got to be able to document, yes, this is the person we have confirmed that it is, and that what they're doing, they're competent to do. You also have to do primary source verification as soon as the disaster is under control or within 72 hours, whichever is earlier. There is an exception that if the disaster is currently ongoing and you haven't been able to do it, you've got to do it as soon as possible, and you need to document why it wasn't done at the 72-hour mark. Obviously, with all the COVID stuff, I think early on there may have been some practitioners who exceeded the 72-hour mark in certain areas that were hit extremely hard, but even in those areas, once that lull sort of takes place and you've got time, I mean, it's got to be a priority if you're going to grant disaster privileges. Now, it's got to be done very, very quickly. Importantly here, disaster privileges are as a courtesy and can be withdrawn by the hospital anytime. And this is a really important point that I think everyone's going to want to know, especially for at least the next hour, is that disaster privileges are in place or may stay in place for as long as the emergency exists, right? So the hospital can keep those disaster privileges going as long as that emergency exists. But I do put a note in here because disaster privileges, in a lot of ways, were not initially intended for long-term disasters and issues, I've seen a lot of bylaws that limit them to 120 days. And what that means is that, you know, we're now into July, and for any practitioners who were given disaster privileges back in March, and the national state of emergency, I think, was declared March 13th, and for a lot of states, it was within a week of that on either side. These practitioners were given emergency privileges or disaster privileges, and we're now at the point where if you've got a limitation, and it could have been 90 days or 120 days, you might want to make sure you know what that is, and either recredential them that way, provide temporary privileges if an important patient care need exists, or roll them onto the medical staff if they've got a clean application and you are processing applications. It's important to make sure that we're not going to let those lapse without intending to or meaning to. So, and that last part I have here too for a tip is to, you know, reevaluate, show that you're continuing to reevaluate. Like I said, this was not initially designed, and the Joint Commission did a presentation a couple of months ago, and during that presentation, they talked about this exact issue and said, well, we want this to be reevaluated, and you know, their suggestion was you should reevaluate weekly. And that is not required by any statute or regulation. It's going to be extremely hard to say that that's enforceable down the road. I do think, though, best practices is going to be for any hospital that's granted disaster privileges to, on at least some sort of a regular interval, document that there is a continued need for your practitioners to have disaster privileges. And what I've started to see now that we're 4 months into this are hospitals that had granted disaster privileges and either see a need for the doctor long-term or want them on staff, those doctors are applying for full privileges. And we're, you know, hospitals are working to get them through and get them on staff. And then at that point, you don't have to worry about whether disaster privileges are going to end at some point sort of abruptly or not, right? Because as soon as you're, you know, the emergency is over, that's going to end. And so thinking long-term, if there's doctors you want to keep on staff, or quite frankly, if the national emergency ends and the state emergency ends and the hospitals are sort of in a position of rolling back emergency operations plans in areas where they're not getting a surge, you may have doctors who are on disaster privileges that you'd like to see stay on staff that no longer have the ability to because their privileges are going to expire by the terms of that cessation. So here's just a quick checklist, I think, that's kind of helpful for for you all to think about how these are defined and what they look like. And what's one thing that's important too is that I put a note there for the NPDB for temporary and for disasters that you still have to run a query to the data bank anytime you privilege a practitioner. And so that's got to be done regardless of what type of privileges you're granting to the practitioner. And so it's helpful to make sure that that's done and done quickly. And make sure that, and one of the things too I sort of mentioned was when you start talking about temporary privileges, you know, you're fulfilling an important patient care need, but you may have an option to extend someone if they're already currently on staff. And that is easier to do, I think, in a lot of ways, and we'll get to that here momentarily. But this is, I think, a helpful this cheat sheet to remember the differences between the two. So I want to talk a little bit about data bank reporting with respect to privileging. So the data bank makes no distinction between temporary privileges, and they define all of them in a group as temporary clinical privileges that they include as emergency, disaster, temporary privileges, all are called temporary, and full-on clinical privileges at a hospital. And so what they say is that if the temporary privileges are awarded for a specific amount of time with no opportunity for renewal, and they expire while the practitioner is under investigation, the report should not be submitted to the NPDB. And I didn't put the full examples in here, but in the guidebook, examples 44 and 45 really touch on this subject. And it's consistent, the logic for the data bank, at least here, is consistent with data bank reporting generally. And what it is if a practitioner, whether they're on emergency privileges, temporary or full privileges, if they are under investigation or under a professional review action as that's defined by the data bank, and they resign while that's ongoing, it would be a reportable event. If instead something else causes their privileges to expire while that occurs, so let's say they're under the doctor's suspended, and while suspended, we don't hit 30 days, and the emergency privileges end on their own, or that the emergency operations plan is rescinded by the hospital, so the emergency privileges automatically end at that point, and we're on day 20 of the suspension, there's no report. Because regardless of the suspension occurring, that practitioner lost their privileges as a result of some other administrative action, and the administrative action is therefore not a reportable event. So just keep in mind that for this purpose, there can be reporting, but that the data bank is consistent with both temporary and full-on permanent privileges. So we'll shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about some of the current challenges for the medical staff. And what's interesting is we talked about some of these issues over the last several months, and I talked about these issues back in May, and then again in June, and they've shifted a little bit since then, but in a lot of ways they haven't really changed. And part of the key here is, as we've gotten further into this COVID situation, I think a lot of hospitals are taking a proactive and should take a proactive look to say, what is it that we're doing currently that we've either got to unwind down the road or plan for down the road? For example, if we're taking advantage of the waivers, what does that mean for us long term? But also, not only how do we unwind it, but are there things that we're doing that we want to continue to do as this moves forward, or are we going to be required to do even after the emergency situation as it's, you know, sort of been defined goes forward? And really, one of the questions that keeps coming up is, are these changes temporary or permanent? And I agree with Annie, I don't know. Some of them are likely going to be more permanent changes. I think she's right. You're going to see telehealth expand significantly. That may be cabined somewhat by certain states, whether they require practitioners to hold a license within the state in order to provide telehealth services in the state like Texas does. But I think you're going to see a loosening of the federal regulations on a lot of those things, and I think the states will likely follow suit if there's shown to be an ability to do so. You know, COVID-19 rates decline, right? What kind of effect does that have on your hospital, right? It's probably from a larger standpoint, you know, that's something we all want to see, but we are seeing restrictions for hospitals based on, elective surgeries. And, you know, in Texas, they were prohibited for a while. I think most places they were prohibited for at least some period of time. They got rolled back and permitted in Texas back in May. And then 2 weeks ago, the governor issued an executive order and stopped elective surgeries in four counties. And those counties essentially encompass Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, and Austin. Right. And so we've seen a re-restriction of those services. And I know I've seen some health systems that have voluntarily stopped those elective procedures in the surrounding communities because, you know, for example, in Dallas County only encompasses a portion of the overall DFW area. So DFW is roughly 7 million people, and Dallas County is about 2.5 million of that. So a lot of the hospitals fall outside of that Dallas County window where the restriction has occurred, and those counties are seeing, I think, less of an increase than Dallas currently is, but it's important to sort of know, hey, look, if you're just over the border, are you seeing an increase such that you want to limit your own elective surgeries, or does that make sense? And then, you know, we talk about a second wave. I don't know whether, you know, I know initially there was talk about a second wave. I don't know whether this is still the first wave or considered a second wave. I think it depends somewhat on where you're at. But certainly we are seeing resurges in certain areas. And so this is, I think, very pertinent to think about, you know, even if we roll back restrictions at one point, we may have to put them back in place down the road. And in some states, you know, visitors are not permitted at the hospital. And we're still seeing that. So one of the questions that's come up that I've had to address several times is, you know, surrogate decision makers. How do you consult them? If you have a patient in the hospital, whether a COVID patient or not, if they're not competent to make their own decisions and you need to talk to a spouse or a medical power of attorney or a guardian, how do you do that, right? Some hospitals, some states are prohibiting visitors. Others are doing it at the hospital level and prohibiting visitors. You've got to be able to talk to them. And I think we've seen more of an adjustment to this now that we're 4 months in. But initially, there was a lot of concern, and hospitals had policies in place that banned any telecommunication devices. You know, you couldn't have a patient walk in and use Skype or Zoom and talk to, you know, have the doctor hold up the phone to the mom, or have even somebody else there for the patient holding up the phone and condoning it. I think a lot of that has relaxed. But, you know, a lot of the state laws that deal with informed consent have obviously not been altered. And, you know, Texas, for example, if you've got a surrogate decision maker and that decision maker is making medical decisions on behalf of your patient, there is a requirement that that is documented in the medical record. And it's got to be done either through a signed informed consent by the surrogate decision maker or by having that decision maker countersign the medical record. Well, obviously, if they can't come into the hospital, it creates some challenges. They're not something that can't be solved, but we've got to be proactive about thinking of those because we don't want to be in a situation where we're consulting a surrogate decision maker and there's no efforts made to countersign the medical records. And then a year later, there's a question either from a surveyor or let's say a different family member that's further down the line of decision makers decides to sue and says that we provided inappropriate care by, you know, entering a DNR or not providing patient care that was consented to by a child or someone else higher on the decision-making list, and we don't have the justification on the backside that shows, oh, no, this was documented contemporaneously. You know, here was the consent. Here was what they consented to, and here was a discussion about what I did as the physician to communicate with them and what we were able to provide. I think that's just something to think through and be aware of. So another thing to look at is for credentialing of providers. So one of the questions that came up early in this process was, you know, committees aren't meeting. We've got a lot of hospitals where, you know, it was full-on emergency mode. Credentials isn't meeting. MEC isn't meeting. Board isn't meeting or some combination thereof. What do we do with our providers who are going to, you know, their privileges are going to expire in March, April, May. Right now we're into July. What do we do? And the Joint Commission has, in their rule, they permit extensions, and this is not a new rule. This was in place already, but was really highlighted once this happened. You can do it as long as, you know, three conditions are met. You've got a national emergency has been declared. We've got that. That may end at some point in time, though, so this is going to be very, very tricky. The organization has activated its emergency management plan. Okay, most of the time we've done that. This is what you're doing for disaster privileges as well. And number three, extending is not prohibited by state law. I think most states have caught up to this now, but early on this was a little bit tricky. So, for example, in a lot of states, the governor can extend the credentialing requirement and extend it beyond the two-year recredentialing window as required by state law. Some states are silent about the recredentialing period. Some say 3 years because DMV hospitals allow that. Some, a lot, will say two. But you'll see in some states, and in California they had this, the governor issued an executive order that permitted the extension of privileges beyond 2 years, and everyone went, oh, great, we can do it. But the problem was is that order delegated the authority to the Director of Health and Human Services to waive the requirement, right? So you still had to have the second action there where the Director of Health and Human Services also implemented the actual waiver. And so for all these waivers, it just always becomes important of, you know, whether or not you even use them, because the waiver is not something you have to take advantage of, though you may certainly want to. It's knowing whether or not it applies at the outset. So for hospitals where this is true, and we've got, you know, obviously we have the national emergency right now, if you've got your emergency management plan in place and state law allows it, you can extend providers and you can go beyond and let them go beyond 2 years. There's a couple points to discuss though, right? So the first one is the duration cannot exceed 60 days after the declared state of emergency has ended. So we're running up on that if we don't get an extension here in the next couple of days. So it could be that all of these extensions that hospitals have been doing since March, in some cases, you know, all of a sudden if it expires July 25th, you now go 60 days and it's September 25th. So a couple, you know, key points come in there and just says, well, you've got all of your practitioners who were due after that who weren't extended, they've got to be credentialed on time. And you may have a big backlog of providers that you've got to go back and do as well. And you've got 60 days to catch up. So that's extremely daunting if that's been done and we don't have a plan in place as to how we're going to credential this many providers. I mean, there's a lot of larger hospitals that have to credential 200 doctors a month. And so if you've done no credentialing for the last 3 or 4 months and you're looking at having to credential those 800 doctors plus another 200 in July and in August and then potentially in September, you know, how are you going to credential 1,000 to 1,400 doctors in the next 2 months if the emergency ends? And so this becomes a little bit daunting. You know, we don't want to miss things. We have to have the ability to go back and ask questions if red flags show up, because we don't want to roll doctors on that are problematic. We're just pushing a problem down the road that we could take care of much more easily on the front end. So the planning is very important. And for the Joint Commission, they basically say that the organization, the hospital, is going to determine how the extension will be documented. So making sure that we're doing that the right way and identifying that the extension is taking place, why it's taking place, and also putting in a plan to make sure that we can credential this doctor timely as we go forward. I have a note there for NPDB querying as well. And here's why this is, I think, really important, is because you are still required to query the doctor every 2 years. If you don't have to, and continuous query satisfies this requirement, by the way. If you don't have continuous query, and let's say your doctor is going to, his privileges expire 7/31, and the hospital decides we're going to extend him because we don't have a primary source verification from New York or somewhere else that we can't get all the documentation yet, we're going to extend the doctor. That's fine. We can extend the doctor. If you don't have continuous query, you still have to run continuous query before you hit the two-year mark. Otherwise, you violated that component of the querying requirement, right? So it's important to know that. And that component's going to come up twice, because what a lot of hospitals are doing is, let's say the doctor was due to expire May 31, and they've extended. And they're going to extend beyond for 4 or 5, 6 months, you know, because we're not going to go, let's say it's the end of September, we push back for 4 months there. Even if you ran the query in May of 2020, if you give that doctor two-year privileges in September of 2020, by the time that he comes back up for reappointment in September of 2022, you'll be 26 months from when you queried last. So this is a note that you could breach this component right now, or you could query the doctor again right now and still wind up breaching it 2 years from now. And I know that they're not surveying right now, but obviously I think if a survey happens down the road, and this becomes an issue when we're hopefully well beyond COVID 2 years from now or 3 years from now. In the cold light of day, I don't know that the Joint Commission is quite as forgiving as we would like them to be on this particular point if this got missed. So it's an important point to bring up, and if you don't have a continuous query, I think I recommend it to everybody that wants to sign up for it, because then you find out what's going on with the doctor if a data bank report is made. Otherwise, it could be almost 2 years before you find out. One other issue that has, you know, come up here is for peer review generally, certain matters during this time have continued to need to be pushed through the process. I mean, we have doctors who were suspended when all this happened, where investigations were ongoing and the doctors were provided certain rights about how long the investigation was anticipated to take. If we had a hearing that was set, certain things have to be done. Others have been pushed off by hospitals or delayed for certain reasons, but, you know, as always, be careful not to delay too long. One of the issues that comes up is the longer a peer review matter is pushed off to address, whether it's a behavior concern or another conduct concern or a quality of care concern, if this concern was arising in March and we get to August or September or October before a letter is sent to a doctor that says, hey, we've got a concern about this, it starts to become more difficult as time passes to say how concerned we are about that particular issue if we've allowed it to go unresolved for 5 or 6 months. Now, there's certainly some difference here in this situation than generally speaking if COVID weren't going on, but it's important to keep in mind, because if you're still meeting and the doctor can say, well, you continue to meet and nobody talked to me about this, it just creates another hurdle to say, well, here's why it's still such an important issue and why we need to be able to do it. And so I mentioned, you know, do you have the ability to meet? Is the committee meeting? You know, I think most hospitals have moved to at least electronic meetings or virtual meetings so that those can continue to go forward. And, you know, do we have the ability to perform an investigation? I think in a lot of situations you do, you may have to alter how the investigation is done, but you can still do them. And so making sure that you're planning for that moving forward is extremely important. So for the and for the extension, you know, just to go back, our recommendation has been to try to avoid extensions so that you're not pushing off 200 doctors at once or 100 doctors at once in a month. Try to keep up. You know, we're responsible for tracking it as a facility, so we've got to make sure that we do that. And understand that certain hospitals are not going to timely provide responses. So, I mean, I've seen hospitals that had all of their credentials, they're trying to keep up, and they might have one doctor or five doctors that they can't get all the documentation from, so they extend those five. And they are only extending them indefinitely, but putting them back on the docket as soon as they get the information they need. So, you know, we had a couple doctors that I saw that were getting recredentialed from New York. We couldn't get a response because the hospitals were getting hit up there. Once that sort of subsided, we got the responses. The doctors were recredentialed after 2 months of an extension, and then that was provided. So we're trying to keep up as we go forward, so there's not a huge crunch at the end. And then, Emma, I'll turn it back over to you here quickly for the CLE question.
Thanks, John. This is the CLE polling question. In order to receive your CLE certificate of attendance, you must answer this polling question, and we're going to give you all about a minute to do so. All right, back to you, John.
Thanks, Emma. So as we kind of talk about how we're going to adjust to the pandemic and some of the peer review changes, we talked a little bit about, you know, going to teleconference meetings and having those. I think a lot of hospitals have done that. I really think it's important, though, and this is probably important for a lot of hospitals to think about, is to have a confidentiality statement or an agreement. And there's concerns here, right? Because otherwise, you're in the hospital, you have the meeting, they're in the boardroom, everybody comes in, you hand out the paperwork while they're there, and everyone's there. You don't have to worry about someone being, you know, well, currently now, nobody's probably on the bus or riding public transportation, but there's everybody's there and they're present, and there's no one overhearing the conversation. If you go to a teleconference meeting, there's no promise that, you know, the doctor's family's not around, the neighbors aren't around, they're not somewhere that, you know, where publicly that information can be shared, and that is in a lot of ways impossible to cabin and contain. But just reminding your committee members of the confidential nature of that process, of the PHI that's involved, of the peer review privilege, and reminding them how important it is to have that, and just giving them a statement to say that they can sign that says, you know, I acknowledge and understand that I'm going to maintain confidentiality and make sure that I'm not in a public place when the meetings are ongoing. It's helpful from a facility standpoint to make sure that it's both a gentle reminder to the doctor not to do those things, but also as a protection down the road in case someone says that, you know, peer review information was inadvertently shared in a way that waived the privilege, and you didn't do anything to prevent it or to prevent it, and we can point to this and say, that's not true, we absolutely did, and here's what we did, and we notified our practitioners, and we made sure everybody was up to speed. I think that's helpful. I also put in here, you know, the ability to conduct physician interviews. And this is important because, you know, right now, as we are working through actually talking to the practitioners and performing investigations, we've got to be able to interview doctors. And doing it over the phone is hard because you want to be able to oftentimes see the reaction of the provider as you ask them questions. You want to see how they respond, what their inflection looks like, whether they're concerned about it, all of those things you lose on a telephone conference. So one of the ways that we've done this is to have the room at the hospital still be available for the practitioner, set up a webcam, have a medical staff coordinator or an assistant or another practitioner who's there that's on the committee. You know, you start the meeting generally with a teleconference call or a video call for the practitioners. When it's time to interview the doctor, you physically bring him into the room at the hospital with a webcam set up. The interview is conducted, and whether he sees you or not is less important than you being able to see the doctor or your members seeing the doctor. They can conduct the interview, and then when it's over, you can say, okay, you know, you can dismiss the doctor, and then someone is there to make sure he physically leaves the room and doesn't hang on to the phone and not drop off the conference call to hear the deliberations and can't continue to watch what everybody else is doing. We've got confirmation the doctor has left. The person can walk back in the room, confirm Dr. So-and-so has left, and the meeting can go on. And so it's just a matter of, I mean, these aren't terribly complicated issues, but it is important to think through them because we don't want to have slips and issues where down the road doctors are still sort of there. On the telephonic and the webcam attendance, one of the questions that I just bring up is, you know, do your bylaws permit it? Right? It's not required. Joint Commission doesn't require that there's some affirmative statement that allows you to do it. But I have seen bylaws that prohibit telephonic or webcam attendance at meetings. And it's not uncommon because what they don't want is for practitioners to just say, well, I'll attend the MEC meeting at 7:30 by telephone. Right? And they do it every month and they never actually show up and deliberate and engage, you know, pre-COVID. And so a lot of bylaws will prohibit it or prohibit it for certain meetings. Or it'll say that if you want to have a telephonic meeting, you've got to issue special notice that requires certain things to happen under your credentials policy or your bylaws to give notice to the committee members of what's going to be talked about, when it's going to occur, what time, how you access, right? So it's different than your normal scheduled meeting. And so just be aware that you may, even though you're allowed to do it, you may have, your bylaws may need to be adjusted through MEC and board resolution to permit you to do it, even if you otherwise want to do it one way or another. Just adjusting generally, I mean, like I said, confidentiality statements are important. You might be able to also provide documents to practitioners through a WebEx or another online platform that doesn't allow printing capabilities. So you don't have to worry as much about, you know, normally where you'd hand the documents out to the doctors during an MEC or a board meeting. You can share them with them on screen. They can look at the records. They can go through them. They can't print them. They can't save them. And then it's, you know, the virtual equivalent of handing the papers back at the end of the meeting and walking out. I continue to record minutes the same way. Obviously, note that it's a virtual meeting, but still record attendance, what was discussed, and what was sort of done. I put a note in just that if you don't want, if the hospital doesn't want, you know, telephonic meetings to occur post-COVID, you can consider permitting them only when emergency protocol for the hospital is implemented or a state or national state of emergency has been declared. Could be a good way to limit when those are permissible. I'll talk a little bit about some of the specific peer review issues that I've seen come up. And for a lot of these, they're going to be very, very fact intensive, but I just wanted to provide some of the things that I've seen and some of the issues that have come up and just sort of the way in which these are sort of analyzed, the lens through which, you know, I look at these. So for call coverage, you know, the issues come up of doctors who have said, well, I'm not taking call, right? And some of them are in a, you know, they're older physicians who are in the riskier age bracket, or they've got an underlying medical condition that they may or may not have explained to us, and they wouldn't have necessarily had to tell us, or they may have someone at home who's vulnerable, and so they don't want to be exposed to COVID-19 patients. So in these situations, I mean, one of the things that has just come up is, you know, what do we do with these folks? Because a lot of times the bylaws will require that the physician provide call coverage, or they'll have a contract that requires that as well. So, you know, is peer review of these doctors appropriate? And in some cases, it might be. But it also might not. And this is going to be very fact-intensive. And these are two pretty extreme examples. But, you know, one example is if you have a doctor who's on your call schedule, being paid for being on the call schedule, and you call him at, you know, 2 in the morning and say, hey, Dr. So-and-so, you're on call. I need you to come in for this particular issue. And he says, no, I'm not coming in. I don't want to catch COVID. I'm at a particular risk. I'm not coming in, right? That is potentially a problem because now you've got a physician who's currently on call that you're relying on that's refusing to come in. That, to me, is a very different situation than a physician who comes to you before they're on call and says, hey, look, you know, I'm particularly at risk, or my wife is at risk, or I have a kid who's at risk, and I'm going to take a leave of absence because I don't want to see any patients while this is going on. I'm not seeing any patients at my clinic. I'm totally stopping my practice for the next several months. I can't take call. That's qualitatively different than a doctor who simply refuses to cover call but continues to come into the hospital every day to see patients and continues to see patients at the clinic or refuses to do it, as a first example, outright when the emergency is occurring in the middle of the night. So those are just some of the things to sort of think about while that's happening. You know, and also, is the physician performing other cases at the hospital? If they're at the hospital every day and they just don't want to be there at 2 in the morning, that's probably not a valid reason to not be on the call schedule anymore. If they've stopped coming altogether because of a concern for their health, that's qualitatively different. Behavior issues. You know, disruptive physicians, how do you deal with them at this time? I've seen a lot of hospitals that are, I think, quicker to respond because they don't have the bandwidth administratively to deal with disruptive practitioners who are causing problems. But it's also important to know what caused the disruptive behavior. Is it during an emergency when you're trying to deal with a COVID patient and people are trying to not, you know, donning the incorrect PPE and the doctor is yelling at them to get the right stuff on because they're not dressing per protocol? What was the underlying issue? Is there a history of this type of behavior with the doctor? Right? What is this? Is this a first incident? Is this a doctor who's normally very calm? What's the underlying issue? And then also, just be aware, you know, if they're placed on a performance improvement plan or a behavior contract, what are the terms of those agreements? You know, I saw one hospital recently had one where they were going to require the doctor attend a course, and COVID hit shortly thereafter while we were still within the window, and the course shut down. Right, and so it became, we couldn't require that he go to the course because they wouldn't do it. Some of them are trying to start making sure that they continue to do it. PACE has gone virtual. They have a virtual option. So you can send a doctor to PACE without actually requiring them to fly to San Diego and stay out there. And then think about also how long does the physician have to comply. In some situations, you might want to still require that they attend the course in person, but give them a longer period of time within which to attend the course. You know, formal investigations, we talked a little bit about this, so I'll go through this quickly. You know, are the resources available? If you've got a suspension, you might suspend a doctor and this investigation might be slowed by COVID-19. So are you required to report? Right, if that investigation goes over 30 days, the data bank requires that you report it. But what if it's because you can't do the investigation from lack of resources at the hospital or because your committees have just shut down? So in May, this is worth noting, I mean, this is part of the data bank issues these guidances that are not binding but are helpful to understand how they're thinking about the issue on the underlying regs. And the question is it reportable? And it's, you know, essentially we're very busy. We summarily suspended a doctor. And can we hold off submitting a report until we're able to complete the full investigation? Is it reportable? And this is a very, very long-winded way of the data bank saying, yes, it's still reportable. And the basis for them is to say any investigation, you know, regardless of how long the investigation takes, if the summary suspension exceeds 30 days, it's reportable. Regardless of whether you could conduct the investigation or not conduct the investigation, doesn't matter. It's the fact that the restriction was in place over 30 days. I do think that there is at least some issue here for the data bank, because normally you only void a data bank report. So let's say you suspended a doctor, it goes over 30 days, you file the initial report, you lift the suspension and reinstate the doctor. Under normal circumstances, you'd file a revision to action report and say suspension lifted, doctor reinstated. In this situation, there's at least some argument that a practitioner or his lawyer might make to say, well, look, the actual investigation took you 2 weeks, after which you reinstated me fully to the medical staff and lifted the suspension. You should void the report, which makes it, you know, takes it off the data bank entirely, sends notice to everyone who received it that it's been voided and no longer there. You know, you might see a doctor raising this argument, and it's at least a colorable argument that I think hospitals will have to address as to whether or not, if a report was made during this period, whether avoiding it would be appropriate or not. And importantly here, I think the most important thing is, and I think a lot of hospitals are already doing this, but just to think proactively and plan ahead. You know, did you extend physicians? You know, do you have a plan to get them processed once the emergency declaration is over? Have you made your sheet and made sure you're compliant? Have you done your data bank queries? You know, if your peer review matters have been pushed off, get back on track. Get those back in front of the committees and make sure that they're going through them. You know, be proactive. You know, you might not have the ability to address details later on. They're going to be forgotten once we get beyond this, just sort of general human nature. Be flexible. I mean, this situation has continued to evolve and change, and I think it's important to be flexible and try to make sure that we're always thinking creatively about how we respond to some of these issues. And, you know, when will this end? Yeah, your guess is as good as mine. You know, in March, I would have told you it would be over by June. I would have unsurprisingly been wrong in this situation. I don't know when this ends. And I think to Annie's point, I think this will, even once things start to open up to some extent, I think COVID's going to be around for a lot longer than anybody thought. And so it's at least worth trying to stay ahead of it and making sure that we're adjusting and planning accordingly. Okay, Emma, I think I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Awesome. Thanks, John. This concludes today's webinar. A recorded version of the presentation will be available on the Pulcinelli website as well as our COVID-19 blog. DLE certificates will be emailed directly to all those who answered the polling question within 24 hours. Thank you for your participation.